my mother died while I was in prison.
Yeah.
And I just took it like, okay, that's those are stuff that happen when you when you're in prison serving life. You got to prepare for that on day one. Mm. But the most anxiety and traumatic experience, other than going to prison, that I suffered was coming home from prison.
That and so much more coming right up on today's episode of The Podspotter.
On an evening in early December 2018, the young CEO of a cryptocurrency exchange reportedly dies while on his honeymoon in India. This death is not announced to customers for another month. And when they're told Gerald Cotton is the only person to hold the passwords to their funds, conspiracy theories grow, leaving some to wonder, could Gerald Cotton still be alive?
Honeymoon, moving the body, all the missing money. It was like, but what happened?
A death in cryptoland. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Then you likely hit that like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
It's really a pleasure. I've been screening hundreds of podcasts.
At the age of 19, Edmond Dantès seemed to have the perfect life. He was young, in love, had his whole life ahead of him, when a wrongful conviction sent him to the most notorious prison in France, where he would spend the rest of his life. Dantès naturally turned to thoughts of suicide and despair, until an unlikely encounter with an Italian priest and intellectual would save his life. Through the walls of their prison cells, the old priest taught Dantès history, science, and philosophy, turning him into a well-educated man. When the priest dies unexpectedly, Dantès seizes the opportunity to escape and after 30 years away from home returns once more to Paris to right the wrongs of his past transgressions. It's unlikely that when Alexandre Dumas wrote The Count of Monte Cristo in the mid-1800s, he could ever conceive of a podcast and the prevalence of the medium by 2021. But if he were alive today, there's little doubt that at the top of his library would be the hit podcast Suave. Suave chronicles the incredible true story of David Luis Suave Gonzalez, who in 1988 was found guilty of first-degree homicide. He entered prison as a juvenile at age 17, expecting to leave in a coffin. But after a surprising relationship forms with acclaimed journalist Maria Hinojosa, Suave finds the inspiration to devote his life to education. Through the walls of a prison cell, Suave begins his schooling by learning one word a day from a fellow inmate. This leads him to paying other prisoners to read to him in exchange for cigarettes. Over time, Suave would earn his GED and eventually a bachelor degree from Villanova University, a feat that took 16 years. The U.S. is the only country in the world that allows minors to be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And even though some states have begun making changes, approximately 2,500 juveniles have been effectively sentenced to die in prison. Suave would have been one of those juveniles. Then, suddenly, after 30 years in prison, a surprise Supreme Court ruling paved the way for Suave's unexpected release. But unlike Dantès, who escaped and after 30 years remained hell-bent on revenge, Suave used his newfound education to keep his sights set on redemption and reform. Joining me to discuss all things Suave is award-winning journalist, author, activist, podcast host, and founder of Futura Media Group, Maria Hinojosa, and subject of the podcast, author, activist, college graduate, and public speaker, Mr. Suave himself. Thank you both for being here, and thank you for sharing your pod with us today. How are you guys?
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Of course, of course. Why don't we settle in with an introduction maybe from you, Maria?
I do a lot of things because I'm a Mexican immigrant, so I never say no to work. So, you know, I'm a professor, I have a company, I'm an author, I'm a speaker, blah, blah, blah. But also in 1993, when I meet Suave in the maximum security prison in Greaterford, Pennsylvania, There was some sunlight shining on me that allowed me to see this person in front of me who was asking me a question and allowed me to pause and speak to him. And I try to tell my students, I've given a couple of commencement speeches just recently, and I'm trying to tell people, like, there are these moments that happen in life, these decisions that you make that you don't know where they're going to end up. And they're all part of the little grains of sand, I suppose, that make up the castles of our lives in the long term. And I'm just so glad that that Suave approached me and that I decided to listen.
And Suave, about an introduction from you for our audiences.
I'm just the luckiest man in America, probably. A blessed person that grew up in the South Bronx, then moved to Philadelphia, to the Badlands, and end up in a situation that no human being should end up. So today, I'm just a person that found humanity in other people when other people don't. And I recognize that. And I also say I'm just blessed that in 1993, I had the opportunity to sneak into a prison graduation. I had to sneak in a graduation in a prison. But I met the most wonderful person that really had an impact in my life. You know, and I say that with an open heart, because not too many people had impact in my life or could make me cry or could make me think, you know. So when I met that person, Maria Hinojosa, I realized that even though I was in prison, I could be a better individual and I could create a better life for myself. Even though I was in prison, I'm home. I'm home after serving 30 years and some change in a state that told me that I was supposed to die in prison.
As far as I knew when I met him, he was a lifer, which meant he was coming out in a box.
The reality is I had a life sentence. There's no parole in the state of Pennsylvania for lifers. So you got to mentally prepare for the worst.
But then,
slowly but surely, inmates sentenced to life without parole for crimes they committed as juveniles are getting a second shot.
A landmark Supreme Court ruling gives him another chance.
Luke Collins, an inmate at a state correctional institution at Greaterford.
What's going on? I thought we were going to talk at 2. What happened?
I wanted to let you know that I no longer have a life sentence.
Driving away from Greaterford! Stop it! We're driving away!
I took a bath.
You took a bath?
Yes. What? Bubble bath, y'all. I haven't taken a bath in like 34 years.
Yeah, and you smell like it too.
The bulk of this podcast is that relationship, that playful relationship, and you both talk about the meeting quite romantically in 1993. And maybe Suave, you could take us back and talk a little bit about that sneaking in and about that chance encounter the first time you met.
You know, to me, it was like a day that I planned it and plotted on, because before that I was just coming out solitary confinement, and an old head, what we call old head, the older gentleman in the prison, you know, approached me. He was like, listen, man, you got to slow down. You just can't be going in people's cells, taking people's property, taking people's commissary, because that gets you hurt in prison. And I was like, man, I don't care. You know, it's a little tough guy, knucklehead. So he gave me a radio. He said, look, I'm going to give you a gift. Gave me a radio. And I was so happy. But when I went to the radio and plugged it in, it was only like 3 stations. 3 Philly stations. And one of the stations was WHYY, which is where Maria's shows used to come on. And I plugged it in. And I hear this voice. And I'm like, what? They got a Latino on the radio in Montgomery County. And it used to come on at 3:00. So I used to wait for it. And I just felt like the shows was about me and they talking to me. So my friend, he was the institutional tutor. He graduated like 29 Latinos with GED that year. And they told him, you could pick the guest speaker. And I was like, listen, you got to get this lady up here. So they managed to contact Maria to get it in. But the principal was like, you not coming in the graduation. You a troublemaker. You don't even belong around here. And I'm like, cool. There's nowhere in the world that I'm in graduate prison, a corrupt prison, and I can't get in a graduation in the chapel. So, you know, I find out who's the guards working the door. I'm like, okay, I could get in. And I remember I went in, I had a whole pocket full of marijuana because my intention was to go into graduation and get the people that's graduating to cop the weed from me and give me cash money because the people with their families could bring cash money, sneak it in, and I could get rid of all my weed in there. And I was like, yes, this is a money-making thing. It was going to work for me. But then I sat down at a bench, and Maria was sitting next in the same bench, but she was speaking. And when she was speaking, I felt like she was speaking directly to me. Mm-hmm. And I just felt guilty. I was like, man, she's messing up my heart. Like, oh, my God, what's going on here? But I felt so empowered. I said, I want to talk to this lady, right? Because everybody was talking to her. And I got a life sentence. You know, there was nothing at that time that Maria or anyone could do for me to help me get out of prison. So asking for help, to me, was like the last thing in my mind.
Maria, what motivated you to spark this relationship with Suave?
When you get inside a prison, I mean, not most people are not going inside prisons. The data shows in our country, it's probably still true, that prison population is among one of the fastest growing. I would say now immigrants in detention as well. So I was like, this is a part of our of American society, an integral part of American society that is fast growing. And yet we don't know anything about it. People don't come here. People don't see it. You know, they don't. Many of the young men and older men who came to see me after I gave that commencement speech, the graduation speech, they were kind of like, you know, what can you do for me? Can you stay in touch? Here's my case. Can I send you? And you know, I understand that. I wasn't surprised by that. Suave didn't come saying, hey, do something for me. He said, what can I do? What can I do in this situation?
I love the quote that you can be the voice for the voiceless. This rang, you know, that hit you, Suave. And Maria, I think I read in an interview that this was something you would say to people to see who it would work for, to see who it would ignite.
Well, and by the way, I don't think that they are voiceless. I think that was a, you know, the way I was seeing it then, it's legit what I was saying, but I think there's a whole conversation about they're not voiceless. It's just that no one ever, you know, gives them a microphone to tell their stories, right? So they do have voice, but they are not given agency in the owning of the voice. But In the communication between Suave and I, it was just like, bro, you're going to be in here. Mm-hmm. I'm on the outside. I've got this other platform. There can be information flow here. I'm a journalist. I want to know. Mm-hmm. And I think Suave was like, well, here's an opportunity to be in touch with a journalist. If the shit hits the fan inside, I know I have access to a journalist who can say, start asking questions. I think we both understood like that was something primary. But then what ended up happening was, you know, I went back to visit a couple of times. I went back to visit once with Suave's brother, Tony, who's in the documentary in our Suave podcast. And I, you know, in the podcast you hear, I'm a Christmas card lady. I send Christmas cards, and I was always sending Suave a Christmas card every year, because I knew what his address was. And I knew where he was going to be literally for the rest of his life. And I think Suave and I kind of, it's weird, you know, because it could have gone nowhere, right? I mean, he could have never responded. I could have never gone to visit. The Christmas card could have gone. But we, I think, connected on a human level, which ultimately leads us to this podcast, which people love. And thank you, by the way, Zach, for being a listener to the Suave podcast and for loving it. We made it with a lot of love and respect for Suave, too.
I learned how to read and write to write Maria from prison.
Just so we're clear, you're saying that you had been raised in the United States of America, going to school. You're saying you did not know how to read or write?
No, I didn't know how to read or write.
You knew something. You knew...
No, I knew how to write my name. When I came to prison, I knew how to write my name. That's it. Took me 7 times to get a GED. It's almost 6 years. And in my 7th try, I got it. Once I got that, college program became available, I signed up.
But before all of this, Suave says he was on a death mission.
I can honestly tell you today that if I would have never met Maria, I probably would have been dead in prison. Probably would have been dead. I asked her, what can I do? You know, then I'm serving life. What can I do? I ain't know how to write. I tried to get somebody to write the letter. Then, then Maria came back and did an interview. And then she sent a box of books. And and that box, it was her first book, which was the book that she did the interview when she came back to the prison. And I pay another inmate. I tell him, look, I'm a, for every two chapters you read, I'm going to give you a pack of cigarettes. Pack a cigarette in the prison is money. That's money. So he said, okay. So he started reading and reading until he read the whole book. Then I'm like, read it again. Because I was trying to memorize this thing. I had it to the point where I knew every page. And to the guy that was reading, he was like, man, this is a great hustle. You know, because I was giving him cigarettes. He's making like 10 packs of cigarettes every 2 days for me. Right? Which in the prison is like, $100 That's like $100 in the prison.
And the wage in prison is about 19 cents an hour, right?
19 cents.
Yeah, yeah.
And a pack of cigarettes is like $8.
Suave, on paper, the state of New York said you were mentally retarded in 1980.
Mentally retarded with an IQ of 56.
So how on earth does someone with that label go about educating themselves? What are the what are the baby steps of that? How does it...
Solitary confinement for me. It was being put in a place where I had no way out. Because no matter what I did, I had to serve that time in solitary confinement. And then my mother wrote me a letter and I couldn't read it. And I told the guy, listen, I need you to read this letter. And the guy was like, I'm going to read it one time, but you're going to have to learn how to read your own letters. So I was like, I don't know how to read. He said, I'm going to show you how to read. So we used to play, in prison, they got this thing where they play air chess. You know, you screen the number through the cell bars and y'all both have a chess ball. And he was like, we're going to learn, you're going to learn how to read. I'm gonna shoot a word at you. You're going to get the dictionary and you're going to look the word up. We're going to get the meaning. So every day we would go back and forth with words. He would give me like five words and I look them up with the meaning, the definition, the origin of the word. And we started with cat, dog, house. And at first I was like, man, this is some baby stuff. He said, but you ain't know that word yesterday. But it was so effective that by the time I got out the hole at a solitary confinement, I felt like I was prepared to take my GED. And I tried, you know, I tried. And I kept coming short. I kept coming up short because my writing. You know, I could never get the essay part. So, you know, I sat down and I said, you know what? I'm going to get this. I don't care how many times. I kept going back. Got to the point where the teacher was like, not you again. So I said, you know what? I'm going to get this. So I learned how to write. I learned how to effectively write a college paper.
That's fantastic.
When I was walking out the hallway, I just happened to look into a classroom and it was just full of white guys. And I was like, what the heck going on in there? Like, there's no blacks. There's no Latinos. Somebody talking about, oh, that's a college class. I was like, college class? There's no blacks and Latinos in there? I want in. And I told the teacher, I want to go to college. He's one of the hardest professor I was at the campus in Villanova. My first ever grade was a D plus. And I thought it was an A. I was so happy. And all the other students was like, you got a D plus. And I was like, I earned that. That's what I studied for. So the professor was like, if you really want to get this, I could tutor you. And after class every week, I used to sit there extra hour with him. And I used to write stories from little two-page stories. He said, just tell me about your life. Just write about your life.
I just love the fact that that Suave is talking about like good study habits that he learned in prison. I mean, that's
It's study. And to me, but it was a personal now because now I'm beginning to understand how the New York City system, school system failed me and called me retarded and signed papers. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to prove all these MS wrong. I'm going to get this. And it took me 16 years. But in them 16 years, I took a trip around the world learning about the world. because when the day come and they do open that door, I want to be ready. And guess what? It's never over to the fat lady scent.
We talked to Kai Wright a few weeks back for his podcast, Caught, which features kids caught up in the juvenile detention cycle. And one of the things that we spent a lot of time on was this idea that, you know, police stations are sort of like entrenched in the school environment in Black and brown communities. And we spent some time on the prison to school pipeline. And maybe, Suave, you can just paint a picture for folks of just how entrenched those communities are. You know, we talk about how a lot of times schoolyard fights would end up being, you know, police involvement would quickly be part of that just because of the sheer proximity of it.
All the schools resemble so much like prison that you can't tell the difference. I walked into a school not too long ago and I thought I was in a prison cafeteria. I was like, what the heck is this? Same chairs, same structure, same metal detectors. You know, it was almost like I was like, oh, no, I got to get out of here. Because I still have a problem with being in places that resemble prisons or they look like prison cells. I'm not going in there. I'm good. You know, and when we're talking about the school system, what we're dealing with, if it's an institution that's still dealing with racism, plain and simple. 10 minutes from where I live at in Philadelphia, I could jump in the car and go to Montgomery County and it will feel like I'm in a college compound with everything. But I come back to North Philadelphia, all the schools got butt wires, security guards all over. You got to, every class you come out, you got to go through a metal detector, pat searches. You got to put all your belongings on top of a table. That's that prison stuff. That's what they do in prison. You come out your cell, the minute you hit the car, then you got to get, turn around, pat search. I mean, like, we need to do better. I always tell the parents, it starts in the home. It starts in the home. Stop trusting these institutions to fix the problem that you're having at home.
Suave was being raised in the South Bronx by his mom, a single mom, Puerto Rican. Suave's grandparents end up here. His mother is born here. And she ends up raising Suave in the South Bronx. So we're talking like 150th and like St. Anne's, more or less around the hub, at a time when the South Bronx was
burning.
It was being targeted to be burnt for developers who are reaping benefits now or later in insurance. So there was an assault on the South Bronx where Suave is a little kid, actually having a fun time, you know, as long as there was food on the table, which was rough, right? Sometimes. So let's not make it all. But Suave had a community, his mom, the people, they may have been the misfits, you know, in the community, but there was a community in a building where Suave felt like, you know, like there was, again, a sense of community. But all around him, it was chaos.
Crack is now sweeping New York.
Justice Department officials now say there is a direct link between crime and cocaine.
Evidence of heavy money and heavy violent drug traffic is all around.
Caught up in the crosshairs were juveniles, children and teenagers living in low-income neighborhoods, dodging daily violence.
So gangbangers are the role model for these children in this neighborhood.
Kids as young as 12 years old carry beepers. They're connected to drug dealers with mobile phones, who call them to make deliveries of crack cocaine.
So politicians in the 80s under the Reagan administration wanted to look like they were doing something about crime. So they tightened sentencing laws in two ways that really matter for us. First, some state legislatures made it legal to prosecute children as adults. The execution of these policies disproportionately affected kids of color.
Suave is a miracle, and yet he's not, because he's right here. So a miracle, you know, but he's right here. But my God, he could have spent the rest of his life. And look at this human being. He's a poet, a walking poet and an artist. You know,
you know what, Maria? I look at it as like, this is like in my family, it's like a curse, because I have a nephew that got locked up at 17 years old. And the only reason he didn't get a life sentence was because the Supreme Court, like a month later, ruled. However, he ended up with 57 years. 57 years in the state of Delaware for just being with somebody that killed somebody. And I often find myself trying to make that connection. What went wrong between me and him, you know, and our family? Every time I talk to him, it's through the phone. I never met him in person, like, at all.
Could you talk about that Supreme Court ruling that got you here, that got Suave in front of us?
So many kids were being sentenced to mandatory life without parole. Mandatory life without parole. So many kids. And so on the one hand, you had these activists who were like, this is an injustice. And on the other hand, this is why I love activists and scientists. My dad, may he rest in peace, was a scientist. Because the scientists were saying, you know what? We need to study the brain. And what they uncovered, which is what we all know now, is that there is such a thing known as the adolescent brain. Hmm. And you are an adolescent up until the age of 26.
Yeah.
And an adolescent brain, for those of us who are parents, I know, Zach, you know exactly what I'm saying. It's a toddler brain.
Yeah.
An adolescent brain does not understand the consequences. It's like, no, I mean, come on. We've all been adolescent. You're just like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll go walk with this stranger or go do this or, like, you know, I mean, all the things that we did and survived. So the scientists made an argument that you cannot be sentencing a person with an adolescent brain as if they were a full-grown human being. And then, as Suave says, that they were grandfathered in. Then it was like states. Hmm. We recommend that you go back and you see if you have juvenile sentenced to life without parole, and you should open their cases, but you don't have to. And by the way, you know, a lot of this is being challenged right now as we speak. So in many ways, Suave did make it out.
I want to hear those words. I want to hear from that mind. I want to hear the words you penned down to read before the judge at your parole hearing. This is a reenactment from the podcast. This is episode 2, The Hustle.
I, Luis Gonzalez, feel sincerely grief and express remorse for causing the death of Daniel Martinez. I could not imagine the amount of grief and pain the family have suffered as a result of my actions. I felt tremendous guilt then, and I still do now. The day Mr. Martinez died, the irresponsibility of Luis Gonzalez died also. I have felt remorse every day since, because I'm aware of the ripple effect of my actions. To not allow Mr. Martinez to be in vain, I realize I have to continue taking on the challenges of becoming an instrument of love and kindness, as well as becoming a crusader to end violence in our community. I'm sorry I failed each and every one of you as a man, brother, uncle, a friend, and most of all, a citizen. To my mother, I'm sorry you never got the chance to see your only son become a responsible man. I'm sorry for being an embarrassment to the family. I only hope that one day I'm able to serve my community with integrity, honor, and respect.
Some beautiful words coming from someone labeled mentally retarded. Suave, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the process of sitting down to write the words that could potentially decide your freedom.
I was part of the destruction that I'm seeing today in the community. I was part of that. And I just feel that enable for someone to come back into the community, you have to offer them a sincere apology. You have to be straight up with the community. Because I live in the same community with what I offended at. I live in that same community. And that's why it was important for me to come home. I didn't want to party. I didn't want to. The only thing I wanted was to come home and apologize to my community on day one. It's an honor for me to serve my community in whatever way I can, each and every day. Each and every day. When you're able to see some of the victims' family, like I did not too long ago, I'm passing out food down North Philly. I bumped into the victim's cousin, and he's like, oh my, you're doing good work. You know, like, it's those moments that tells me, like, you got to keep going. And I told Maria this not too long ago. I'm just starting to feel like I'm almost free. I'm not completely free, but I'm almost free. And it's hard, you know, to come home after 30-something years in prison and try to be like everybody else and playing catch up. And
well, social media alone, I mean, like, I can't imagine, like, we had the benefit of getting like a little bit here and then a little bit more and then MySpace and Facebook. And then it's just all thrown at you. Like,
it's hard. I mean, listen,
ideally, you know, my daughter turns 38 and that's when I introduce her to social media. But I can't imagine what it's actually like.
I'll tell you what, right? My mother died while I was in prison.
Yeah.
And I just took it like, okay, those are stuff that happen when you're in prison serving life. You got to prepare for that on day one. Mm. But the most anxiety and traumatic experience other than going to prison that I suffered was coming home from prison.
I want to play a clip real quick, just more on that tough transition into civilian life from your time in prison.
Sometimes I get frustrated because I admit to you, I'm still on jail time. And what I mean by that is that sometimes I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and just staying there thinking that somebody gonna come for count. Then I remind myself, yo, you in your own place. Nobody coming for count. Like, going to a restaurant and keeping the spoon in my pocket. Yo, I've done that a few times. I wrap the spoon up and put it in my pocket. I've done it a few times. And it's embarrassing, but I tell the people that I'm with, like, I trust them. I know them. Like, yo, if you see me do this, just tap me, man.
That was so traumatic for me, not knowing where I'm going to get a job at, how I'm going to pay my rent, how I'm going to eat, how I'm going to take care of myself. Like, and there was times, and I'll tell you that now, there was times when I was like, shit, I wish I was back in grad school, but not with a life sentence, but I wish I was back where I ain't had to worry about all this out here. You got guys that come home from prison and instantly become homeless. I know a bunch of them like that. I go down Kensington right now and I can point you 10, 20 guys that I know from prison and then become hooked to drugs.
For juvenile defenders, though, the recidivism rate is really, it's good, though. I think on your pod, you mentioned it's like 1%.
But the reality is the suicide rate that comes with that. We haven't talked about that.
Got it.
You know, just 3 days ago, we just lost another juvenile life. Uh-huh. You know, yes, they're not going back to jail. But the pressure of being out here is leading a whole bunch of them to OD. You have a lot of them that can't deal with the pressure of being out here, so they commit suicide.
And that's what makes me really sad about this society of ours, America. You know, we're supposedly the land of the free and all of this independence and liberty. And it's actually, no, we're a very incarceral state. We incarcerate so many people. And yet we don't take responsibility for what happens. And it's such a loss.
And I've been on both sides. You know, because I seen my grandfather get killed in front of me. I just had my niece murdered in December. You know, and that was like the hardest thing for me to tell my family, have some mercy on that guy. When that guy just killed my twin sister's daughter. I'm over here telling her, have mercy on that guy. You know, so I never want to be there. So, yes, I live my life like it's the last day.
He walked in while he was giving me my haircut and shot him. Shot him in the stomach. And said, hey, boom, just shot him. Really didn't say much. Just shot him. And I seen my grandfather. I knew he was dead when he fell because his eyes rolled back. Seen plenty of them in the neighborhood. So, and that was the day that I always say, you know, I kind of lost, like, all sense of reality for me. Like, you killed my grandfather, so I'm entitled to kill somebody else, too. If I'm hurting, somebody gonna hurt.
That was my mom friend at that time.
It's just a symptom of this real sick part of our society. And Suave, you know, when I think about Suave's story, and he has extraordinary support because Suave made it happen. It didn't just, people didn't just fall on Suave. Suave is active. He's very much full of agency in his life. But Suave got out of prison, and that drive out of Greaterford to Philadelphia, Suave was throwing up the entire time. I remember I came home. I left you at the halfway house. I don't know if we spoke that night, but I think the next day you said to me, I'm still dizzy. I'm still dizzy. So this, the physical effect of having been incarcerated in a space for 31 years and then coming out, and you're just like, it's overwhelming. You feel sick.
It took me like 3 weeks to really get over that. Like throwing up, you know, people say, what's the first thing you ate when you get out? I'm like, I can't even remember because I couldn't enjoy nothing, eating nothing. Because my system, every time I tried to eat something, I was throwing up everywhere. I couldn't get in a car. And even to this day, you know, I was just thinking about that I could pretty much move into a bigger place if I want. I can afford it now. I can move into a nice place. But I choose to live in a studio, right? Because of the fear of being in a bigger space. Because I've been in and confined places for so long that I don't mind living in the studio. To me, it's cool. You know, and I was thinking about it, and I had a conversation with someone. And they asked me, why are you still living in the studio when you can be in a house? And I'm like, because it works for me.
Yeah. Well, then, Suave, I have to ask you about lockdown. Then I have to ask you, like, you get out of prison, you're free for two years, and then the country goes into lockdown. What was COVID like? What was you got to be confined. You got to stay in your studio now.
No, I didn't. Yeah. That's a whole different for season two, right? But I keep you, I tell you.
We got a little exclusive here.
Well, let me just say.
Let me say this real quick, right? And I'm going to say this, and then Maria going to say, because she know where I'm going, right? I didn't. I decided to work throughout the whole pandemic. I was working for a city agencies that we help homeless people. So I went to work every day.
Wow.
And then one day, you know, I hear the phone ringing and you know, and you got to listen to season two. But I'm going to let Maria take it from there. Well, but I say this, the pandemic to me really didn't bother me because I said, I'm not staying in. I'm going out. And I was walking Center City around like nothing was happening.
And that was the whole thing, was that it was, and Suave's playing it off like, no, it didn't impact him. It did. And you're absolutely right. It was another form of lockdown. And Suave was like, I'm not having it. And it was terrifying. I was battling COVID myself here in New York, in Harlem. My husband was battling it. And I just couldn't conceive of Suave going out into the world and exposing himself. And so season two includes a little, we don't know yet because we don't even have a season two. We're thinking about it. We're trying to make it happen. But there is a moment where I completely lose it with Suave, and I don't yell at people. And that was a hard moment because I told him, because Suave came up to New York recently. And so we were able to finally be together face to face. And I had to say to him, it was very hard. It was very sad. But I was like, Suave, My greatest fear would be that after everything that you've been through, that then you, in service of wanting to give back, that you go to the street and you're working and you get COVID and you don't make it.
But I remember I told Maria this, and I wanted the world to know, like, Greta Fall could not break me. And I told Maria, I'm immune to all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then I started experiencing everything that comes with being an ex-felon, everything that comes with being incarcerated, where people was giving me a job, but when they from my background check, oh, you've been in prison, we can't, you know, we can't have that. I went through that moment, and that was depressing.
Yeah, you're on social media. You must have just had no patience for people posting like, oh, I can't go to my favorite brunch place, or like,
no, because I was going out.
I got no patience for you.
I seriously tell you, I was going out. I was helping people in the community, and I was working with the most vulnerable people in Philadelphia, the homeless population, mentally ill, right?
Yeah.
I still worry about Suave every day. I still worry about Suave every day. Every time when I send a text and I don't hear back from him immediately or a phone and I worry. Mm. And so, again, for the greater question is for our society, like, what good is it doing? And, you know, putting people into prison for these tens of years, to what end? Mm. You know, so I think that that's the bigger, because especially when you see Suave and you're able to see him out and about, you know, and it's just like, wow, but this person could have spent the rest of his life with those nasty brown scrubs on.
We'll be right back. We're here to fill the role of looking for great content for you. If you like the show, please check us out, subscribe, visit thepodspotter.com and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at thepodspotter for lots of good stuff. Please leave a review, subscribe, rate, and judge us on Apple Podcasts and help spread the word. We release every Monday with a review of a new podcast, and we're going to just keep going, keep plowing ahead. If you have suggestions for pods, that's helpful. If not, it's okay. We're going to be here anyway. Hit us up on our social media platforms or thepodspotter.com. Thanks.
The pandemic has really boosted my art career.
Hmm. Oh, something to plug?
No. You can, you know, but I'm an artist. Do it. I'm an artist and I sell art. I'm signed to Morton Contemporary Art Gallery in Philadelphia. And through the pandemic, I became one of their best-selling artists.
Am I looking at an original behind you there?
All original. Wow. And I tell you, I went from selling one painting a month to selling four or five paintings a month through the pandemic. Wow. So I don't know what happened there, you know, that somebody said, you know what, we feel sorry for this guy. We're going to buy his art. And, it's been great. You know, to me, it's been great being home. It's been great being free. It's been great sharing because I'm pretty sure people are listening. But at the same time, I want people to understand. I wish I had a better ending. I wish I could have said, you know what? I went to Harvard and graduated and became the president of a 500 Fortune company. That wasn't the ending for me. The ending for me was I went to prison as a juvenile, served 30 something years, came home, went back to prison the day after, literally a year after I came home, worked through the pandemic, and I'm still happy. I'm not bitter about nothing. I'm still happy that I'm able to serve my community. And to me, that's success.
Guys, I ask all my guests for a piece of audio, something from your pod that you particularly love, that you would like inducted into the Podcast Hall of Fame when it is inevitably built. Is there a moment, a song, a quote, anything that particularly stands out to you that when people see the Suave kiosk and they hit the little red button, a little sound will play, it'd be this?
Wow.
For me, it is episode 6. Almost at the ending, when I tell Maria, we all got a life sentence that day. Everybody involved in that case left there with a life sentence, whether they went to prison or not. Because everybody's life's changed.
Hmm. I did the time. I sacrificed my life. You know, that's how it goes. But they were all kids, man. We were all kids. All of us. Right there, December 6, 1986. Right there. 15 seconds. Changed my whole life, man. Changed not only mine, changed Serrano's life, that the victim's family's life, my family's life. Everybody had something to do with it. Everybody, whether they got caught or not, their whole life was changed.
And I don't know. I think for me, there's so much tape that didn't make it into our podcast. And so there's so many conversations, really, really powerful and intimate. But I think the thing that captures for me the extent of emotion is when I find out that Suave was rearrested. And there's that scream. It's a blood curdling scream. When are you ever screaming that way? So I was very surprised. And that scream captures to me the emotional, the level of emotion in this podcast.
Fuck! 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 Fuck!
Oh, fuck it, eh?
Hello?
Maggie?
Yeah, hi.
Suave is back in prison.
Yes.
And the other voice that we hear on your podcast, Maggie, the producer, she's constantly sort of challenging you throughout your podcast about that emotional availability with Suave. And it's an odd criticism to me because I, you know, week after week talk to investigative journalists and people that I'm like, hey, how do you not get emotionally involved in these? Like, how do you stay robot the entire time? And finally, like maybe 2 weeks ago, I had a journalist say, he wished he'd been more available with one of his subjects. Some of the story had been compromised because he didn't, he held back when he could have gotten intimate, more intimate. And so I guess I'm wondering why the Maggie voice on your pod, what was she a manifestation of criticism that you were receiving about your emotional availability with Suave? Or why was that so prevalent in the podcast?
Because when we give Maggie finally, I mean, you know, remember it's years and years and years of phone calls. We didn't have any money. You know, we're a nonprofit. Yeah. We had to try to raise the money. And finally, when Maggie is able to sit down for an extended period of time to hear all, she was like, this is a relationship between a source and a journalist. And that's a big part of the story.
Mm.
And I at first was like, what? Like, that's so not interesting. Like,
oh, no.
But then
beautiful, though.
I had to pull away, you know, and I was like, okay, I have to recognize, yes, there is this stuff. It is these series of conversations. And so Maggie really was the producer and we decided, well, she's got to anchor this because I can't anchor it because I'm part of the story. And Suave and I, you know, we are very transparent. We're still working stuff out. The difference is that Suave and I also realize, because we realize we're adults, that like, okay, well, this is, we are creating journalism. When we record our phone calls, you know, on my little recorder, it's not salacious. It's because we understand that the conversations that we're having here are actually important, not just for Suave and I, mostly for Suave, in the sense of his healing and his, but it's actually important conversations for everybody to hear.
Sure.
And in my view, that's why I can, Suave would have been completely dismissed by entire society because he was incarcerated. And that's what we're trying to say is open your eyes to see the humanity around you. It is around you. The Mexican guy who is delivering your pizza, who delivered your pizza throughout the pandemic, look at his humanity. Or the people who are washing the dishes, you know, in the restaurants, or the people who are, you know, the cashiers in the grocery stores, right? That you all just, the essential humanity. And for me, that is the Suave story, is his essential humanity. And plus, he frankly is a poet.
Yeah.
Really, the way Suave speaks is poetry.
That means the world. It's almost like that Christmas card I got, that first Christmas card. I was in jail for 30 something years.
And the only person,
the only person that ever sent me a Christmas card was Maria.
Yeah.
And every year I always tell myself something else come through to be fine, you know, but at least I know I'm getting one Christmas card. And it's the same thing that I tell people, language, language, language. You never know when a kind word could resonate with somebody else.
So as part of that, you know, on the pod, you talk about how the parole system kind of makes you sort of portray yourself. I'm one of the good ones. I'm one of the good. You say that a lot of energy has to be spent pleasing people.
When I came home, that was the case because, yeah, you know, you come home, you've been away from society for so many decades that now you want to be part of that society. You want to be part of the human things in the community, social events. You want to socialize with people. You don't want that label that I've been in prison. So you try to be what other people want you to be. But if you're asking me today, no, I don't give a shit What matters to me is that I'm happy with myself and that I'm kind to other people. I'm the living dead. I was serving the life by incarceration till you die. You know, and to come home and say, I'm a comrade, or I'm going to just be kind to a stranger, or just pay for somebody's groceries. And I'm not rich. I got to work for my money, you know, because I never want to forget where I come from. I never want to forget them lonely nights and them cells where I wish I was out here. Now I'm out here.
Suave, I'm going to have your words take us out. And it is a clip from that moment at the cemetery where you do say your victim's name and accept that responsibility. And I just want to thank you both for doing this. And thanks for talking to me here today.
Thank you.
There was really only one thing left for us to do in this story with Suave.
We're coming to the cemetery to pay respect to somebody that
didn't deserve respect?
No, they didn't deserve to die.
We finally find it. It's a windy fall day, and bright color leaves blow in the air between rows of gravestones. In the distance, we can hear a leaf blower. It's sunny, and the cemetery is quiet. Suave walks to a small gray stone and leans over it. He runs his hand over the etching. Daniel Martinez, 1972 to 1986.
Man, I just hope that if anything come out of this, man, that people, young kids learn, man, that I mean, to be standing on the grave site and to be the one who's responsible for that, I live with that every day. I mean, I owe my life to that, to him. I really do.
Yeah.
You know, and being here just reinforced that I could never go back. Somebody lost their life for nothing.
Suave shoves his hands in the pockets of his sweatpants. He stands there for a minute, looking at the tombstone. Quietly.
I want you to know that it could have been a total, complete, absolute loss. It could have been. And somewhere along the line, you made a decision to turn this around. And I know how upset you are, but you turned it around.
Thank y'all for bringing me here.
We're always looking for new suggestions on a fresh batch of pods. Please tell me what you're listening to and what hosts you'd like to hear from via thepodspotter.com or Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at thepodspotter. Thanks, everybody. This has been Zach Robidas. The Podspotter is created by the Price Brothers, produced by Oink Inc. Radio, associate producer Tori Adams, and is recorded and produced at Baker Sound in Philadelphia.